We got engaged.
Arrogance in the rest.
That'll do.
Keep up to date with the latest WSL action and the biggest interviews.
Team keeping an eye on our games. It just shows how big we're growing.
Subscribe to the Koi Gig podcast stream on the OTB Sports app now.
The News Run on Off the Ball
with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, start your razors.
This is News Talk.
Welcome along, Joe Malloy with you this evening. We've got a brilliant show for you. A very interesting, eclectic mix of topics, good and bad. Certainly in the bad category, extraordinary testimony from Azeem Rafiq, the former Yorkshire cricketer at Westminster this afternoon. Allegations of the most serious kind. Extraordinary testimony across 2 hours. Sean Ingle of The Guardian. With all the details, he'll join us 7:30. If you're not following this story, I promise you it's worth sticking around for 7:30. Football show between 9 and 10, the multi-talented Saoirse Noonan on a league-winning season at Shelburne, and her international career really kicking off as well this year. She's coming up around 9:30. Miguel Delaney at 9 o'clock, talking about various things, including Michael Owen, frankly, is just damn bored at how easy international football is for England. He wants the whole thing restructured. We can't be playing San Marino, says Michael Owen. And then Keith Earls has written a new book, as I'm sure you've seen. Genuinely, this was recorded a week or two ago now, three ago maybe even, with Keith Earls. It's an extraordinary interview. He's extraordinary, and he's coming your way at 8 o'clock. So Keith Earls on the way at 8 o'clock. 53106, the text number. We're at Off the Ball on Twitter. Richie McCormack, good evening.
Joseph, how are you?
Yeah, very well. And Dave McIntyre, good to have you with us.
Evening, gents. How are we doing?
All good. I don't know if you've been following the Azeem Rafiq story or any of his testimony today, but quite extraordinary, the revelations and the allegations and just the upset at the whole situation. Just a culture of racism at the club. And he was before a select committee this afternoon, and at Westminster, those select committees are often very, very good. I know we have the parliamentary equivalent here at times, which can be hit or miss, but they really got into it this afternoon. So we'll bring you a whole host of those clips. And Sean Ingle of The Guardian was there as well with the extraordinary details. So that's on the way at 7:30. And then Keith Earls, 8 o'clock. Dave, I don't know if you've had a chance yet to read the book. It turns out, like so many sports people, like so many people generally, I suppose, that Keith Earls, in the public sphere, had pretty much everything going for him, and privately was just struggling massively with his mental health in a huge way. He was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in 2013. And even then, obviously, he was far from out of the woods, and there was a lot of work to be done post 2013. But it was some relief to him to at least have a diagnosis for what was going on in his head. So really, to have achieved what he's achieved in his career, I think he's up to 94 caps now as of Saturday, was nothing short of a miracle, I think. If you haven't read the book, you'll appreciate it when you do.
Yeah, I've read a couple of excerpts, and I've heard a lot about the content of the book. And unfortunately, at this stage, from one point of view, it's a well-worn path. It's a story we've heard many times, but maybe fortunately as well, if you look at it from another point of view, it's at least a story that is now being told, whereas in generations of sports people past, we may have heard absolutely nothing about it, and it may never have seen the light of day. So it's great that someone like Keith Earls is in a position to discuss it. I mean, the depth of despair that he fell to, and talks of, you know, almost an ulterior persona that he had almost put together in his own mind. I mean, he bordered on schizophrenia, and it's just an incredible story. And Keith tells stories brilliantly. I've interviewed him many times over the years. I've been in many pooled groups of reporters at World Cups and Six Nations press conferences, and you'd be delighted when Keith's put up in front of the media, because he always had a story to tell, and he always had something different and interesting as well. So there's absolutely no reason to believe that the book would not be an excellent read, albeit I'm sure it is harrowing in some places. And I think it's great for him that his career has gone on for as long as it has. We remember him as part of that Munster side 13 years ago now, winning a Heineken Cup and being part of the Lions tour in South Africa in 2009. But given the mental health issues he's obviously had, and given the injury issues he's had over the years, for him to be just behind Brian O'Driscoll in terms of our all-time test scoring legends, I think it's brilliant for him. And there's probably no real sign of him slowing down either, in a position where the competition now from an Irish point of view is absolutely intense.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I mean, he hasn't lost any pace, not to give away too much of the interview or too much of the book, but one of the chats away from what was going on with his mental health focused on his speed. And there was a chapter in the book called Speed. And what was really interesting with Keith Earls, and I hadn't realised this, is that he was quite lucky in that at 16, 17, 18 territory, so really before even he'd become a professional, there was an international sprinter working at the University of Limerick who was completing his thesis on effectively speed and how you increase your speed and how you maintain your speed. And he needed some guinea pigs to work with. And so from that very, very early age in Keith Earls' life, he was learning about things like form and alignment and technique and the correct training to do for explosiveness and the correct weights to do and how you maintain your speed across time. So it's funny, I was saying to him in the interview that in so many of the books that you read now of Irish rugby players who have retired just because of the era they played in, the common tale is often, oh, well, look, first half of my career, we were messing around and having a good time and drinking here and drinking there and the diet wasn't so good. But then somewhere, you know, we towards the end, we kind of clicked into real professionalism and things flourished. You know, that's often a well-worn tale for the rugby players of Ireland that I've interviewed thus far about their books. Whereas Earls, interestingly, is the first one to say, yeah, I've been training brilliantly since the age of 16, 17, 18 and was way ahead of the curve. So if you're wondering, for instance, Dave, why Keith Earls has maintained his pace, that is one of the reasons. And it was just a freak thing that right place, right time, up and coming sports person. And this former international sprinter in Limerick needed a few guinea pigs.
Yeah, it's, I mean, that is very interesting. And he was obviously lucky in that regard, but you have to take that opportunity as well and maximize it to the its fullest extent, which he clearly has done. And when you are blessed with that kind of raw speed and acceleration, timing can often be an issue for you, particularly in rugby where you're not allowed to pass the ball forward. You have to be there in the right spot at the right time. And two moments spring to mind, that crossfield kick from Jonathan Sexton, which was probably maybe phase three or four of the 42 they went through before Johnny Sexton dropped that goal in Paris in 2018. If Keith Earls doesn't get there at the right moment to gather that kick, I mean, we never get remotely close to the 10-meter line where Sexton drops that goal from. And then the hole that he hit to be there for Jack Conan's knockdown against England in the final game of this year's Six Nations. I mean, you get that a split second wrong. He gets there before or after the ball, and that glorious piece of subtlety and set piece brilliance doesn't occur. We never see that try. So Keith Earls is probably being written off in some quarters because he's in the 30-plus brigade, and there are guys like Andrew Conway who are now setting in there. But I'm sure in his own mind, he's thinking, hang on, lads, I'm not quite done yet.
Yeah. By that 2018 period, he was doing a half hour of visualization, positive visualization, every single day. He'd been working with Keith Barry. So he was really in a good place mentally by that stage, and you could see it. Now, his liver was floating around his body and putting pressure on his diaphragm, so he couldn't actually breathe and had a lung capacity of 50%. But that's a whole other story, and I don't know how he managed to perform with that going on. So Keith Earls on the way between 8 and 9. We've had to edit out some of the full interview available for podcaster on YouTube, but we'll play you essentially about 45 plus minutes of it between 8 and 9 o'clock. He's beloved, Richie, Keith Earls, I think.
Yeah, and this is only going to cement it. It wasn't going to take much to enhance his character, to be fair, because he's just so likable. And I think since the moment he broke into the Munster setup, first of all, he seemed almost destined, then obviously for the Ireland setup, but it wasn't a case of this prodigy who was above everyone else. It seemed like a member of the community had made it through to first, obviously, the Munster setup and then the Ireland team, and was very much representative of where he came from. And that kind of stuff can't be manufactured. That kind of stuff can't be faked. And that kind of stuff is, you know, something that the public loves to hold on to. And the fact that he now has come forward as being slightly more, you know, delicate, you know, character, you might say, yeah, and has come through his own troubles, I mean, that's only going to endear him more fully to the Irish public, and rightly so, because there is a link between, as different as the stories are, but there is a link between what Keith Earls has done with his book and coming through about his own problems with his personal life, what Rafiq did today in front of that select committee of MPs, which was essentially to smooth the ground for those that are going to come after him, because, you know, it's not going to be such a big issue. Thankfully, mental health is not the issue that it was when Earls was starting out his career and when he felt, you know, he was under his most duress. And similarly with Rafiq over in the UK in front of that select committee, he said himself, it's not about him, it's about the generation that's going to come afterwards, that they won't have to deal with this, that essentially, in the truest sense of the term, and without wanting to lean on cliches, they're both breaking down boundaries and they should be lauded for that.
Yeah, 100%. I wasn't too familiar with the career of Azeem Rafiq, and I don't think many of us are watching too much Yorkshire cricket, but the testimony today in front of the select committee is extraordinary. We'll play you several clips of that around 7:30. Sean Ingle is going to join us. So a really good show in store. And then Miguel Delaney and Saoirse Noonan on the football show come 9 o'clock. We should start the news round. It is, as ever, with thanks to Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, start your razors. And Richie, you're starting with the retirement of the Irish captain.
Yeah, Ireland captain Ciara Griffin today announcing her retirement from international rugby. Saturday's test with Japan will be the back row's last in a green jersey and her 41st cap in all. Griffin is still only 27. She's been captain of the side since 2018 and was asked about her decision to retire by Nathan today.
A lot of people obviously going to be shocked by this considering your age and everything that's gone on over the last few weeks. You talked about it being a tough year. How much has the last couple of weeks and everything that's gone on and the back and forth between IRFU and players, has that influenced your decision at all? And how difficult has that been for you as captain?
No, that hasn't influenced my decision. You know, just something I'd come to at another time. You know, it hasn't been influenced by the last week at all. Obviously, it has been a tough time for us as a group with everything. But I think something that happened to me and I was thinking was, to be honest, the time of the pandemic, it made me reevaluate an awful lot of things. Made us all, I suppose, reevaluate that time at home, things like that, getting that time with your family. And it just made me, I suppose, reassess different things. And now, I suppose, I have the opportunity that, you know, I can finish at home on home soil, and I can finish on my own terms. So that's kind of been my reasoning.
Yeah, congratulations to her on a brilliant career. Still very young. I think, Dave, it says something about where the state of the women's game is at the moment, that when the news first came through that she was retiring, everybody's, I suspect, first thought was, well, this is because things have gone so badly awry behind the scenes.
Yeah, look, you can only take Ciara at face value. And I mean, who are we to question her? And she's given everything she has for the time that she's been in the Ireland jersey and the effort she put in to put herself in a place to wear it in the first place, that we can't really question her. But I'd be surprised if the events of the last couple of weeks didn't play some part. Now, I know she has acknowledged that if Ireland had qualified for the World Cup and if things hadn't gone so badly wrong at Parma a few weeks back, that she probably wouldn't be making this decision or this announcement this early. Maybe in the back of her mind, she'd always had some sort of an intention to retire after the World Cup, and events meant that was brought forward considerably by several months. But she would love to be leaving the Irish game, given what she's put into it, in a better place than it was when she found it. I'm not sure she could probably say that. It's certainly not through any lack of effort on her part, but certainly Irish international 15s women's rugby is at a low ebb right now. And Ciara probably wishes she could have left it in a better place.
And Richie, news on the publication or not of the review?
Yeah, the IRFU confirming today they won't publish the report into the failure of the women's team to qualify for the World Cup. The union will instead release the key findings of the independent review, which will be delivered by the former Wales international Amanda Bennett.
Okay. I think there was hope that would be published in full. Let's see how detailed they are in the findings and go from there. Meanwhile, there's football this evening.
Yeah, lots of it. The Republic of Ireland under-19s through to the elite stage of the European Championship qualifying. Goals from Sligo's wunderkind Johnny Kenny and Lincoln's Ruan Curtin secured a 2-0 win for Tom Moen's side over group hosts Bulgaria. The elite phase draw will be made in the new year. Republic of Ireland under-21 manager Jim Crawford making two changes for this evening's Euro qualifier with Sweden. Ross Tierney and JJ Coyote come into the side replacing Conor Noss and Collie Whelan for the game at Tallaght Stadium, where there was a 7 o'clock kickoff, and it's still Ireland 0, Sweden 0. And Wales are hoping to secure a home draw in the World Cup qualifying playoffs tonight. However, they're without Gareth Bale for the visit of Group E winners Belgium to the Cardiff City Stadium. There's a three-way dance for top spot in Group G tonight. Should be fun. The Netherlands even can book their tickets to Qatar if they beat third place Norway, but second place Turkey are away to Montenegro. The playoff spot in Group D is still up for grabs. Incumbents Finland are away to automatic qualifiers France, while Ukraine are hoping to capitalise in their game away to Bosnia-Herzegovina, and all of those kick off at 7:45.
Dave, I was watching Ali McCoist almost in tears last night as the Scots stuck it up to Denmark, and then Wales, as Richie says, in a bid to get a home draw in the playoffs. And I'm thinking, well, they're, and Denmark, by the way, are through top of the group. They're three countries comparable to Ireland in terms of size and stature. And here we are, Dave. Will we ever be back? Will we ever be back, Dave?
I went to throw in Northern Ireland as well, because they put it up to the European champions last night.
They were
probably
great,
the better team,
yeah,
and had the better chances and should have won that game. Italy are now heading into the difficult waters that are the playoffs. So, but look, maybe we shouldn't be taking it as a negative. It should be an inspiration, because we know that's where we can get to. And with a Nations League and a qualification for Euro 2024 in the pipeline, almost certainly, hopefully still with the ship been steered by Stephen Kenny, I think there's a lot to be positive about. I'd take anything after watching and sitting through a commentary of England 10, San Marino 0 last night. So unfortunately, I didn't get to watch Scotland beat the Danes or Italy dropping points away to Northern Ireland. I was watching Harry Kane cruise his way towards becoming England's all-time records goal scorer.
I've never heard somebody so disenchanted about an opening goal last night as you on commentary for that. It's like when Maguire's header went in, it was like you knew that there was another nine coming and that this is going to be a long slog for pretty much everybody involved. And it was rough going. But I know you alluded to it there, Joe, at the start of the show, Michael Owen's tweet saying, is anybody else getting tired of the, you know, the one-sided nature of international football? Sadly for Mr. Owen, he's one of these FIFA legends who is under the instruction of their Führer Gianni Infantino to basically espouse the virtues of this biennial World Cup idea that would do away with notionally these games. But, you know, Michael Owen scored a fair chunk of his England goals against sides of the calibre of San Marino. Harry Kane's chalked up his 48 against sides like San Marino and Andorra, and they have as much of a right to be at the table as anybody else. If England happen to beat them 10-0, so be it. Like, for comparison's sake, like, England's biggest competitive wins were both against Luxembourg prior to last night. And like, look what Luxembourg have managed to achieve in the last 10 years. They're now knocking on the door, finishing third and possibly above in groups. So to cut people off at the knees is probably not the wisest idea. And you have to be careful where these calls for a biennial World Cup and a more competitive international landscape are coming from.
Yeah, Miguel Delaney's on the way after nine. We're going to talk about all this with him, amongst other things. And Harry Kane, you mentioned, Davies, and 48 now, so level with Lineker. Charlton, of course, was that magical number for so long for all our youths, was on 49. Rooney's overtaken him since. So you would have to back Kane to overtake Rooney, I would imagine, in the next 18 months. Kane, in the midst of the terrible form for Sunderland, has scored 21 goals for England this year.
Yeah, and I think he's got 13 in his last 11 internationals, maybe 14 actually, and he's broken all sorts of records. He's became just the third man to score five goals in a single. Well, sorry, he was four last night, wasn't he? He was lucky to become the third to score five goals in a single England international. But you say 18 months, Joe, but he's got seven goals in his last two games for England, and he only needs six more to become the all-time scorer. I think that will happen by the end of the opening couple of fixtures of the Nations League. And obviously, depending on who they get, they will be up against stronger opposition given the tier that they will be in. But there will be pre-World Cup friendlies. There will be a World Cup as well if he stays fit. He's probably going to get to play the guts of 9 or 10 internationals next year. He could be England's all-time goal scorer by the end of 2022. I'm just not sure it has the cachet it used to have. I remember vividly Gary Lineker bottling a penalty kick in a friendly against Brazil in 1992.
Yeah.
And he scuffed it off the penalty spot. Taffarel, I think, was in goal. And it was a massive deal at the time. And ultimately, he finished his career one goal shy of Charlton's record. I just think Rooney, I didn't feel the same watching Rooney become England's all-time record goal scorer. And I probably won't when Harry Kane goes, I think, well beyond Rooney. I think he'll get to 60, 65 and make it an almost impossible task.
Well, I would think so. And that will be broken in turn by the next generation through, because England at the moment are just frighteningly good. I mean, you're thinking they breezed through qualification stages here for the World Cup again, undefeated in the group. You compare that with the time of Graeme Taylor or missing out on, you know, missing out on the World Cup, obviously, in 94. Those days are just so behind England now. They're kind of frighteningly good. Rich, we should keep things moving from a news round point of view, and that means cricket.
Yeah, Ireland are going to host the T20 World Cup in 2030. The joint bid involving the England and Wales Cricket Board and Cricket Scotland was confirmed as the preferred candidate today. It'll be the first time since the 50 overs edition of the World Cup visiting Clontarf in 99 that Ireland has hosted a major tournament. Warren Dutram, very happy about that. But I guess it's come, that news, on a pretty bad day for the sport, because the former Yorkshire bowler Azim Rafiq believes cricket in the UK is institutionally racist. He broke down in front of MPs today in the UK as he discussed his experience of playing the sport. Rafiq says he was constantly called by racist epithets during his two spells at Yorkshire. He also revealed that as a 15-year-old and a practicing Muslim, he was held down while alcohol was poured down his throat by a former player. Rafiq told the select committee today that cricket across the UK is rife with similar behaviour.
So you say it's institutional in Yorkshire. Do you think it's institutional in cricket more widely?
Yes, I do.
And is that from experience when you obviously play other counties and so on, or indeed when you know, you're playing club cricket? It's just infuses the whole game, does it?
I think the stats, we rely a lot on data in today's society. I think that back it up. I think other people's experiences now, and I know off the record I have had enough people talk about experiences up and down the country. It's not just at Yorkshire. And I think here the ECB's got to take a bit of responsibility as well. It's all well and good everyone throwing the book at Yorkshire. It is still my club, and I, whether people believe or not, I still have a sense of wanting to talk, make sure that it's not just everyone throws a book at Yorkshire, because this is a problem up and down the country.
It got very emotional at times across his 2 hours in front of the select committee. Sean Ingle's going to join us shortly and we'll play you some of the audio and just give you a sense of the story if you haven't been following it too closely. There are, in less serious matters, a bunch of people texting in to say they completely agree with Michael Owen, by the way. They find international football in the main pretty boring, and their heart sinks when it's a gap week in the Premier League and they're thinking, oh man. And I guess, I mean, from an Irish point of view, at least the qualification campaign has a certain intrigue, Dave, and excitement. And even the dead rubber matches, because of where Stephen Kenny is, have had their own interest level. But generally, it's like, will we qualify? Every game is huge and tension-filled, and the 4 or 5 days build-up and the 2-3 days fallout are all really engaging. I mean, I can sort of see your point. If you're an English fan and it's like, we've already qualified, we qualified months ago, I can see how a bit of boredom sets in with the whole process.
Yeah, from an English point of view, maybe. And they have won so many of their games so easily. And I think this is their 7th consecutive World Cup qualification since missing out on the USA in 94. But in a general sense, I would disagree with those listeners, because I think international football has come on massively in the last 3 or 4 years. I think the opening of the doors to countries far down the pecking order qualifying for the Euros, I think, has been amazing. I think the Nations League has been a massive success, having abandoned the old friendlies, which I dreaded. And I used to commentate on some of them and attended some of them to report on them. And when the Premier League break was coming up, I just really almost cowered in the corner at the thought of having to go and watch Ireland play Wales under Trapattoni in August, in a game that absolutely nobody wanted to be part of.
I can't imagine you cowering in the corner, but...
Oh, those days were bleak. They were grim. But now I do look forward to the international windows. Yeah. The Nations League semi-finals and final, just as an example, were absolutely phenomenal. Mm. And there have been some brilliant games this year, helped by the fact that, you know, recent Dubai is kicking in. We've had a European Championships as well. But international football as a spectacle, for me anyway, has definitely been massively improved in the last 2.5-3 seasons.
Rich, I think you could be right on that Michael Owen link with Infantino.
Oh no, it's a thing. Yeah, it's a thing. Like Gianni. Tariq Panja has pointed it out several times, that there is this group who are contracted as FIFA legends, who were all brought to Doha recently and do have to toe the line of FIFA. So like Michael Owen's tweet last night may have well been prefaced with Gianni Infantino saying, Michael, can you write something like... because this is the FIFA line that the likes of Owen, the likes of Yaya Toure and more have been towing over the last few weeks and months. And it's only going to grow. It's only going to snowball from here, because they want to push this thing through, regardless of the pushback from UEFA and so on.
Yeah, I keep paraphrasing him. What he tweeted was, rapidly falling out of love with watching international football, barring the big tournaments. I think a lot of people feel the same way. Half these games are absolutely pointless. A restructure is needed, he says cryptically. Okay, I think that's a home run.
There you go.
By the way, Dave, in your commentary, I presume the pro that you are, you knew that in scoring, Harry Maguire became England's highest scoring defender ever. Pips, Jack Charlton and John Terry.
Of course, I had I was thankful from the second half point of view that the goals had continued to go in, because that meant Wikipedia was my oyster in the second half, because I had all sorts of information to tap into, because I knew it. Kane scored again. Well, that was going to be another record that had gone, and I had known that Luxembourg 9-0 in the 60s and the early 80s was the all-time competitive record win they'd had. So I had that at my fingertips. And it was different from the game against Albania that I also commentated on during the week, which was they were 5-0 up at the break, and that's where the goal stopped. So that was a complete write-off in the second half. But at least you could be trawling through the record books while commentating on the second half last night.
What a night. Dave McIntyre, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Richie, we're out of time. Sorry, I know a few other interesting stories there. We'll get to them again, I'm sure. Thank you.
They're mostly depressing, Joe, so we're probably better off leaving
a few grim ones there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Richie McCormack and Dave McIntyre there.